Sorry,
Yes,
the volume wasn't
the
it,
volume
did
is
not
not
do
good.
better
I have to
now.
talk loud like this, right?
It's good.
Okay, all right.
Be here now.
You can hear me now. Okay. So I was just saying that it's wonderful that you have come. I think what a fool I would be sitting up here if nobody's in the room and I'm yakking on. So this is good. And I really am grateful for the Sanghas inviting me to come to Tucson. It's a treat for me. So today, this morning, and this afternoon too, I want to talk a little bit about Dogen's essay called Gyoji, Continuous Practice. You all know who Dogen is, 13th century Japanese founder of Soto Zen. Gyoji is the longest essay in Shobogenzo. It actually is usually published in two parts. It is always obvious, I guess, when anybody is talking, but it's worth saying, I suppose, that what I'm going to talk about really is how I feel about our practice as I read Dogen. And I imagine for myself what Dogen is saying. I'm sure that if you ask someone else, you'll get a different story. And I don't really know across 8 centuries what Dogen really meant by what he said. But I've been reading Dogen my whole adult life and really appreciate him. And so I'm giving you my impressions, my feelings about our practice as I read Dogen. So I bet you everybody in this room is an accomplished, what we call an accomplished person. You've accomplished a lot of stuff in your life. And to accomplish something is to, master something, to get it right, to do it well. And maybe even in the case of Dharma practice or spiritual practice, to straighten ourselves out, get ourselves to be better people. But as I read Dogen, his understanding of our practice, he's telling us that no, this is not what we're trying to do. We're not trying to be great meditators. We're not trying to be experts on the Dharma. We're not even trying to be great people known for our great compassion and wisdom. We're certainly not trying to have a great collection of Buddhist robes or learn how to be really good at Buddhist bells and whistles and prostrations and all that. Although, if you go to some Zen centers, there are people who really are trying to do that, which is a good thing. I appreciate it when people are enthusiastic about doing those things because when you first take up the practice, you have a lot of enthusiasm and you want to do these things well. And that's good. If you love something, naturally, you want to do it with verve and with passion. But I think none of that is what we Zen practitioners are truly aiming at. I think that what we're aiming at, our fondest hope, is that as we continue to practice, we would get to the point where there would be no gap at all between our deepest goodness, our most sacred aspirations, and our everyday speaking and thinking and acting. That those things would be at all points absolutely identical. Our highest, most sacred aspirations as human beings, our deepest goodness, that we all have as human beings in everything we say and do and think all day long. We hope there would be no gap between these things. And I think that's what we're aiming at in the practice. And I think that's how Dogen sees our practice. I think that's what Dogen needs by this term, Yogi, continuous practice. So here's the opening paragraph of that text. I think this is the Kaz Tanahashi translation. On the great road of the Buddha ancestors, there is always unsurpassable practice, continuous and sustained. It forms the circle of the way and is never cut off. Between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, there is not a moment's gap. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. This being so, continuous practice is undivided. It's not forced by you or by others. The power of this continuous practice confirms you as well as others. It means that your practice affects the entire earth and the entire sky in the 10 directions. Although it may not be noticed by others or even by you yourself, this is so. It's the opening passage of continuous practice. Very beautiful, let me think. In using the phrase, the great road of the ancestors, Dogen is saying that practice is not a destination. It's a path, it's a road, it's a way. There is no standard, and there's no template for a human life. There's no way we're all supposed to be, because every life arises out of the ground of its conditions. My life is not the same as yours, and your life doesn't look like mine or anyone else's. And yet, we all have the question, how do I truly live? How do I fully embrace and express this one precious life that I have been given? There are people for whom this is a nagging question that won't let them rest. There are lots of other people for whom such a question is so far in the background of their lives that they hardly even notice that it's there. Maybe they never notice that it's there. Maybe they live and die, never notice that it's there. Or maybe they do notice sometime when there's a crisis that shakes them to their foundations, under which this question has been long buried. For Dogen, the road, the way, is defined by this great human question. And it's exactly the path that has been trodden by the great sages of the past, whom he calls Buddha ancestors. Dogen was a person who grew up in Buddhist practice. His mother was a very devout Buddhist. He ordained as a young man, so he lived with these ancestors in his heart. He felt that he knew them well. He respected them a great deal. And he deeply wanted to walk their path. And there's nothing more wonderful, nothing more significant, I really feel, in human life than to walk the path of our ancestors and sages of the past. This path is continuous and sustained, he says, and forms the circle of the way, and it is never cut off circle that takes you step by step at every point away from home and back home. Life comes from nowhere. And that's where it goes when it's over. I think we all know this. But who can think about it? We're busy. But we know it. Where did we come from? Where are we going? There's no beginning and no ending. Although, certainly from our human point of view, there seems to be a beginning. There seems to be an ending. You see it written on every tombstone. But in fact, the true circle of our life is larger than that. It's never ending and it's never cut off. No matter what we do or don't do, whether we do spiritual practice or not, we are always a part of this great circle. Well, this is a very different idea than the ordinary idea of me and you practicing what we call Buddhism or Zen, which we think we are doing once in a while, maybe on a Sunday or when we have time. Or maybe we think we're doing it in a regular manner, disciplined manner. Maybe we think we're committed to it over many years. After we die, we'll stop practicing. But that's not what Dogen thinks. For Dogen, continuous practice is a much bigger question than this story that we tell ourselves. It's continuous, all-inclusive practice without beginning or end. And there's nothing outside of it. It includes, as he says, the entire earth and the sky in 10 directions. And even more astonishingly, this endless, continuous practice is the practice that we are all doing every day, whether we know it or not, in all of our activity, not only in our sitting, in our chanting, in our Dharma study, but all the time, in everything that we do, in every moment of our being embodied and breathing and conscious. This is an important phrase, Dokan, circle of the way. You could also translate Dokan as the way that goes round and round. When you think about it, how could eternal, constant, continuous practice be going somewhere? If we were going somewhere, we would eventually get there. And then we would have arrived. And then practice would not be constant and continuous. But it would end when we arrive. Something that is constant and continuous cannot have a destination. It cannot have an endpoint. And yet, it is a road going ahead. It's a going, a doing, an endless activity. Therefore, must be going round and round in circles, right? You probably are aware of the Suzuki Roshi, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, who's the founder of our Zen Center and of our lineage. And he often used the phrase, no gaining idea. By which he meant, you know, don't try to get anywhere in your practice. Just make effort. And if you make effort without goal or destination, you are going round and round in circles. And that is continuous practice, going round and round in circles, the circle of the way, bay that goes round and round in circles. Recent poem of mine is kind of makes reference to circles. At the time that I was thinking about this, I had that poem, I lost it now, but these lines that I'm going to read for you remain. I don't know where the rest of the poem is. But I was thinking about this Dogen's idea of practice going around and around in circles. And the poem is actually about the ocean, which I live on the ocean, so I see the ocean all the time. And seems like half my poems are about the ocean. But the ocean is like that too. You know, it rolls in and it rolls out. It's moving all the time, but it's not going anywhere. Sometimes the ocean is moving with a great force. Sometimes it's peaceful. Always moving, going nowhere. So here are the lines. On a circle. One step away from beginning is a step toward beginning. But no beginning exists as such, other than the illusion of beginning. One merely names that constructs a sad ending. One merely names curve and a crash. Dissipation and undertow. Children love to play in these waves, whose smash, rumble, and twittering backslide, carrying sand up into it and sweeping sand out from below, excites and frightens them until they master it, knowing they don't master it, but master it enough not to fear. Between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, there is not a moment's gap, Dogen writes. This is one of Dogen's most precious insights, one of the most precious characteristic of his practice. And here he's referring to a convention in Buddhism that you're probably familiar with, the archetypal stages of the path. So the first thing that happens in the path is aspiration, the motivation to practice. That's the beginning. That's how the path begins. The moment when it dawns on you, this is what I have to do. It's like a conversion, an awakening, and then go forth in practice. In Sanskrit, that aspiration is called bodhicitta. Thought of enlightenment. That's the literal translation of bodhicitta. And it comes to people in different ways in real life. As I said a minute ago, sometimes a crisis happens in the life. You have some really strong suffering, and there's almost no choice. Turn to the spirit. But sometimes it's a more kind of run of the mill dissatisfaction we might be feeling in our living. Everything is fine, we're going along fine, it's a good life, but something is missing. Sometimes it happens totally by chance. Like you're riding on your motorcycle and you took a wrong turn and you ended up in front of the monastery gate. And you went inside and you were like, wait, this actually happened to one of our Zen Center people. Or maybe you can't ever let go of the memory that you had as a child. Of the smile on the face of the little Buddha statue that your grandmother brought back from China in 1925. And that's why you end up spending your life practicing Buddhism. One way or another, this aspiration to practice comes up in us, and we practice. And this aspiration is considered the most precious thing. Because it's that moment, thanks to that moment, that we recognize that we have to devote ourselves to the path. And that nothing else will suffice. Now, in Mahayana Buddhism, this bodhicitta, once we begin to follow its dictates, is inherently altruistic. One wants to practice not only for oneself, but with a wish to be a blessing for others. It's a very warm-hearted feeling. It gives you a kind of warm feeling toward everything that exists, not only people, but everything. But it's kind of an odd kind of altruism because although you want to be a blessing to everyone, there's really no one to be a blessing for. Because the nature of awakening is exactly that you go beyond self. Because self is such a tight shoe, right? It's a little uncomfortable. Liberation means to be liberated from that. Going beyond the self, liberated from the burden of self. Seeing through the flimsy, it's quite flimsy, what you notice, quite flimsy illusion of self as we have conceived it, as we have been conditioned into it. And so practice sort of naturally opens us to the reality that everything and everyone always was the self. That's why, although there's no one really to be a blessing for, we feel we want to be a blessing for everyone. So the bodhicitta is inherently altruistic by its nature. So that's the first step in the classical archetype of stages in the path. And the next stage is practice. To practice, and we do practice. And the next thing is we practice until we achieve enlightenment, transformation that makes us radically different. The whole world appears radically different to us, and we live in the world differently, and we respond within the world differently. Same world, same person, everything different. The characteristic of this transformation is that it is now impossible to go backwards. We can't walk backwards anymore. The only thing we can do is go forward in our practice now with this wonderful feeling of wanting to be of service. But that's what we're doing in practice, always going forward, caring for others. And then when we practice like that and we awaken, we finally enter nirvana, complete peace and letting go, nothing left more to do. So that's the classical template of a life in Dharma, common to all Mahayana Buddhist traditions: aspiration, practice, enlightenment, nirvana, which in most Mahayana sutras is said to take many, many, many lifetimes of practice. Lots of lifetimes. But in continuous practice, Dogen sees time differently. Continuous practice does not occur in linear time. It occurs in endless circular time. And that's why he says there's no gap at all between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, because they don't exist in a linear progression of time as usually is thought. They, Dogen says, not only here, but in many other essays of his, he says they occur, all four of them, simultaneously. on every single moment of time. He says that's the actual nature of real time. It's the whole of the path unfolding, complete, on each moment of time. Time itself is practice. Practice itself is nothing other than time. And time and practice are simultaneous, circular. That's why the good news is there's nothing to worry about in practice. You don't ever have to like worry whether you're doing it right. And there's absolutely nothing to achieve because it has already been achieved. It is already complete as this moment is complete. The beginning is the ending, and the ending is the beginning. And there is no hierarchy of understanding or experience. Everybody is a beginner. Everybody is an expert. So when Suzuki Roshi says no gaining idea, he's not wagging his finger at you and scolding you and saying, don't have any ideas about your practice. He's just describing reality as it actually is. That's the way it is. Whether you are on the fifth day of intense Zen Sesshin, far away in the mountains, or downtown at a meeting in the big corporate conference room, when you fully give yourself to a particular moment of your life, aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, right there without anything left out. Practice is continuous and perfectly available on every moment. You don't have to go to a retreat far away and seek out a famous teacher. Dogen says this in a lot of places. Why are you running around looking for all of this stuff? It's right there in front of you all the time. And after a while, this is very clear. Throughout various conditions, various states of mind, because mind, states of mind can be quite ragged sometimes. You know, get a bunch of really bad conditions going, like they don't feed you for a week, and they put you in a little room with no lights, your mind will be ragged. You will not be a happy person. And yet, aspiration, practice, enlightenment, nirvana will still be there. Probably this is not true of you guys, but I run into a lot of people who are allergic to religion. They don't like it because it feels like all religions give you a set of beliefs and rules imposed from outside that you're supposed to believe in. And it feels coercive. But here Dogen writes, continuous practice by its nature cannot be imposed. It cannot be imposed by others, and it cannot be imposed by yourself. Because continuous practice, he says, is unstained. That's Kaz's translation. A word that essentially means without discrimination. So this is a subtle and a very important point. Because our mind, our daily life, our every perception depends on discrimination. I'm not you, you're not me. Up is not down. Strong is not weak. Here is not there. That's how we know what the world is. That's how we live. Things must be distinguished one from another. This is how normal life is possible. This is how we can meet one another. But it also makes our everyday normal lives subtly and sometimes not so subtly painful. The gaps between things, between people, between peoples, filled with oceans of longing and pain, filled with comparisons, condemnations, oppressions. Continuous practice heals this rift. It is wholeness. It's the opposite of all divisions. The great trap, which is very hard to avoid, is to identify continuous practice with a concept of continuous practice. As good an idea as continuous practice is, when you make it an idea into an idea and impose that idea as a standard on yourself and others, it becomes harsh. And we do this to ourselves. Continuous practice is living beyond standards and impositions. It's full engagement and full appreciation of whatever it is that our life happens to be in this moment. Continuous practice is unstained. This is a very radical and thoroughgoing thought. No marks, no boundaries, no definitions. Because continuous practice is just life itself. Life itself. Life itself also includes death. No life, no death, no death, no life. So, being unstained, continuous practice goes beyond this fundamental distinction that we hold on to so tightly, that I'm alive and not dead. Someone is dead and no longer alive. Continuous practice goes round and round with no gaps and absolutely nothing excluded. When you sit in Zazen, as soon as you feel forced, as soon as you force yourself, as soon as you insist on shoving your mind this way and that way, you are conforming to some standard. And you see immediately that this is painful. So what we want to do on our cushions is the opposite of that. We want to enter this moment as it appears and let go of all impositions. We want to take a breath and relax into our present condition. The essence of practicing Zazen, as Dogen presents Zazen to us, and there are different, of course, presentations of Zazen, and perhaps what I'm saying here is foreign to you, the way you're used to practicing, but for Dogen, what Zazen is exactly forcing nothing. Life at every point has its own imperatives, regardless of what anyone has to say about it, because life is not what we think it is. Life is what it is. And we can sit and see all of our bright ideas coming and going. We're so smart. But every idea doesn't last too long if you pay attention to it. Comes, it goes. So we're really just sitting in Zazen, trying to not have our various ideas tyrannize us. And sometimes we can't prevent that. Of course, we are tyrannized by our thoughts. But when you sit in Zazen, at least you know that. You know what's going on. So you're not quite as spun around by it, quite as fooled by it as you otherwise might be. And this is why Zazen is very great. I mean, I've been doing Zazen for many decades, and somehow or other, I haven't gotten bored with it yet, even though I'm still the same person. Because Zazen is such a clear and simple human situation in which there's nothing to worry about, nothing to be accomplished, and all you have to do is experience this unique moment of your life on the most basic level. Just the feeling of being alive, period. That's it. It's a very clear and simple human situation. And it makes it really easy for us to experience our lives in a moment, whatever moment it is, with clarity. He says, the power of this continuous practice confirms you as well as others. That's a great line. Once you get the hang of this, Zazen, and you're just willing to let yourself be as you are in any moment of sitting in Zazen, letting go of all your resistances to that and all your various impositions about how you're supposed to be, do Zazen. This is the feeling that you have, that your life and the life of all others is fully confirmed. This is an amazing thing, just to feel this is it. This is life right here. It's fine. Doesn't have to be better. It's just fine. How could it be any other way than the way it is? You think about it all the time, you know, we're adjusting. Could it be a little better? A little warmer? A little more salt? A little less salt? Did you really have to say that? What about the government? This feeling of one's life as being confirmed as it is a wonderful and really important basic human feeling. What does it mean, really? We're all human beings, all of us. We are all members of the club. So what's wrong with us? How could anything be wrong with us? And yet, let's be honest, there's something wrong with us. Right? There is something built into us that is inherently off kilter. It just is, if we're honest. Not that there's any reason for this, or something we're supposed to do to straighten it out, but we have that feeling. The Christians brilliantly called it original sin. Buddhists call it dukkha, fundamental unsatisfactoriness of our human experience. It is an inescapable human subjective fact. And yet practice confirms us. It gives us balance. It sets us right as human beings, even though we don't really need to be set right, because we are, even as we are unsatisfactory fundamentally, we are also at the same time Buddha. But without practice, we don't really know that. We don't feel it. We don't live it, even if we believe it. So practice confirms us. It's a beautiful thing. Practice confirms us in our connection to everything. Nothing on earth or beyond earth is not part of our practice. And as Dogen says, therefore, our practice has an impact on the entire earth and the whole sky. We may not be able to see how that's so, but it is so. I don't think any of us know the measure of our Zazen. Somewhere Dogen writes that. He says, not all the Buddhas in all the worlds could even begin to measure the virtue of one moment of one person's Zazen. He says that's somewhere else. Now, we're living in the regular world, and in the regular world, there's right and wrong. It's practical. It's good and bad. There is no living without discrimination, preference, and choice. And yet life itself, existence itself, is larger than that. This one continuous eternal moment of our living is beyond preference, beyond good, bad, right, wrong. When you give yourself to any moment of your life, it is completely right, it is completely good, and it is utterly confirmed. And it's not complicated. It's not an esoteric thing. It's really simple and straightforward, however immense it may be. Another way of looking at this is gratitude. No matter what's going on, there is so much in any moment to be grateful for. I mean, look at us. Here we are. We didn't produce this moment of our lives. We didn't fashion our own human body out of our intelligence and our know-how. How did it happen? And yet it did. We are alive. And see and hear and feel and taste and touch. Beautiful world, co-created exactly to fit our sense organs and our consciousness. Ellen and I were talking about the Dharma and fun things to be here. It's schmoozing with Al out in his little patio there. Of course, we're always talking about Dharma, our favorite subject. And we were agreeing that this is the tricky part. Practice is continuous and constant. There is no way not to practice. And everybody's already doing it.
True.
It's true. But just believing in that somehow isn't enough. You can fool yourself quite easily with that wonderful, inspiring ideology. You actually have to practice. That's the thing. You have to do it. And you not only do it, but you have to give your whole heart to it. No matter what. And that's what we do. We practice. We sit. Walk. Study, we chant, we pay attention as best we can all the time, and we do all of this together with our friends. And we do it not as a duty or a sacrifice, past, accomplished, but as our most precious joy. We enjoy it. We love it. It's fun. What can be better than hanging out with our friends, discussing the truth, what it is to be human, understanding that we will never get anywhere with that discussion. And it's wonderful to have, and it's inescapable. What can be better than that? I can't imagine. So I close my talk with another poem, recent one. This is in sentences, in prose. It's called As I Rise. And these simplest of elements occur to me as I rise. that the heft of the soul prevents anything untoward from occurring upward is simply as clear as any visual effect. Listen to it, this rush of wind. It waves the tree tips, rushes through the grasses. If there's a woman, let her be as she is. If a man, let him wave his arms about. See things yield to time's disturbances. The shade is drawn all day. No sun shines into the room. And at night, the light bursts forth. I'm determined to complete the journey once begun. Determined to begin, finally. If the sky were higher than it is, there would be no moon, no star. I seek what I shall never find, for how find what is nothing? Nothing, in itself nothing. These longer books, no one can read unless there's a plot to follow. But the eye sees the spaces between. I'm not sure of anything more than this, the current thought, even as it dissolves. Upon this foundation, the world as I know it exists. And then the animals creep forward, searching for food. Thank you for listening to the talk. And my plan ordinarily is to ask you a question and have you think about a question that comes out of my talk and think about it in groups. And I think this afternoon we'll have time for that. I'll give another talk this afternoon and then we'll have time for that. But for now, since the time is limited, why don't we just open the floor to anybody who has a comment or a question or anything like that. I, you know, my idea is we're all practicing together. We're all experts. I mean, who would know more about your practice than you, right? Am I going to know about your practice? And the Dharma is not a thing up in the sky that I know it. I'm going to tell you. You're going to get it right. That doesn't make any sense. So therefore, I don't usually do like question and answer. I mean, have people say things and they're happy to respond to whatever somebody says. So I have a microphone and I can run around and hand it to you if you want to speak. So anybody who wants to speak, and I really encourage you to, and this doesn't have to be a question, it could be something you feel or want to say in response to all this. Whoever wants to talk, I guess raise your hand and I'll give you the mic. There you are.
I don't think I even need the microphone.
Okay.
In an interactive, people-oriented world of politics.
You take the microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just take the microphone.
Oh, I don't hear much.
People can't hear you.
I'm really loud.
Yeah.
It's so hard. In an interactive world of politics and people, is a Buddhist merely an observer?
Of course not. There are no observers anywhere. Everyone is always active. You can fool yourself into thinking that you're not doing anything, but you're always doing something. Everybody knows that, right? Not doing something is doing something, right? You know that.
You now.
No. We're in this world. We're fully participating in this world. There is no other way but to take the next step on the path. There's no other thing to be done. We have to do that. And if we care about others and we care about suffering, we have to do whatever we can to alleviate suffering. I remember once, sometimes I write a book, you know, and then I go to a bookstore, blah, blah, I read from the book and talk, I remember once very vividly someone saying, well, what about my 95-year-old grandmother who's living in a home for like a skilled nursing facility? She is left out of the Bodhisattva equation because she can't do anything to alleviate suffering. I said, no, of course not. She's fully participating. All she has to do is smile to her caregiver and be kind to her caregiver, be grateful for her caregiver. That's how she spreads goodness and changes the entire world. So there's lots of ways to alleviate suffering and change the world, and we always have a way. We're always empowered. We're always, in fact, obligated to find a way to share that goodness. It depends on who we are and where we are and what can be done by us in our situation. Yeah. Great question. There's more. Where is the mic? Oh, you're going to do that.
Thank you very much. Yes, thank you. This is maybe personal and universal. Who knows? But I'm sitting here feeling totally and completely grateful for you. And it goes back into the 90s when I very first met you at a Vipassana retreat. And when you go to a Vipassana retreat, you interact with the teacher one-on-one and do a little interview. And so then you tell them about your practice and they tell you, you know, what you should do to make it better or something like that. So I go to Norman, never met him before, and I'm telling him all about my practice. He just sits there. He doesn't tell me what to do or how to fix it or anything. And I'm going like, wow. This guy is really
good. Anyway, thank you so much. Yeah.
How do your zazen and writing practice influence each other? As a beginning zazen practitioner and writer, I think there's a lot in common, but also it's hard to let go of the need to complete, to progress, and the sense of self and an artistic process, right? And how do you bring that practice into your writing, or how is writing part of your practice?
Yeah, thank you for that. Well, that's a great question. We did a little class at the Poetry Center the other day, and I started the class by telling the story of, those of you who are in the class will remember the story. My friend Gary Friedman, who was a kind of real expert all around the world in mediation and conflict resolution. And he happens to live near the temple where I was living in residence for many decades. So we knew each other, we were friends, and he trains people in conflict resolution. So one time he said, I think you'd be interested to come to my training and see what it's like. And I said, yeah, because, you know, I'd like to learn more about how to resolve them. And so I went to his training, and afterward he said to me, What did you think? And I said, wow, you know, your method for resolving conflict is really, really brilliant. And he said, the only trouble is that you'd have to be an extraordinary person to do that. The method is easy to understand, but to really pull it off, you have to be an amazing person. He said, yes, it's sort of true. He said, the rap that people have about my method is that they say, what a great method, but only Gary can do it. So I said, well, what are you doing to get people to be the kinds of people who can use do that method? And he said, well, that's what I don't know how to do. He said, that's why I wanted you to come to the training, because I have a feeling that somehow or other, Zazen could help. So for the last 25 years or so, I've been working with him. We do lots of trainings, and we use Zazen and other techniques to help people to have a more open and expansive sense of self-reflection so that they're able to do this method. Well, apply the same idea to writing. You go to a writing workshop and they teach you all about technique and they show you examples of great writing. And so now that you have this very high standard and you're trying to achieve that standard, but what are you doing to make yourself the person who's able to pick up the pen and begin to write? What are you going to open up your own sense of access to yourself and your own permission? What if you practiced Zazen and felt this sense of confirmation? Maybe it would give you access to something within yourself that is surely there that would enable you to write. So it doesn't tell you anything about how to write, and it doesn't give you any ideas for writing, but it gives you a sense of yourself that helps you to write. And that's certainly was true in my own writing life, because I was really trying hard to write, and it was a miserable experience. I was in the Iowa Writers' Workshop, struggling, suffering, and when I started doing Zazen, I kind of got free from that. And now, I just have fun writing. I mean, I wouldn't do it if it was drudgery. I do it because I love it, and it's really a wonderful thing. So, and I attribute that to Zazen. And freed me from what I was saying in my little talk, freed me from the tyranny of myself. I mean, there's no worse oppressor than oneself, right? Very get over that. So that's, to me, that's the relationship between Zazen and writing.
Hello. So today is my first time here at the Falcon and the continued practice. But I feel wow, it's because it's definitely resonate with myself, the concept. Because when I was my undergraduate, I learned the relations that in my first class. At that time, I questioned the what is Nirvana or what the Buddha had said, we are already living in the Nirvana, but we just don't realize. I said, I tell the professor, it's like we're living in the ocean, but we still looking for water. Yeah, so in that time, today I think, oh my God, it's that always my own practice, and I feel that Nirvana is the moment I experience this right now. And but we just cannot find it. And we just cannot realize. And the process for myself is the process to realize the beauty of the life itself. Yeah, I feel like that. Oh my God, I said, oh my God. I never read that book and never, I just feel something in my heart. And I feel because I'm in wheelchair, it's my life, but when I realize I also have my own beauty, I feel peaceful. Yes.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. I couldn't agree more. And I think what, something you said there is very, very subtle, you know, because you said something like, we're in Nirvana, but we can't realize it. And it's true, because if our whole mind and our way of being in the world is of necessity, discrimination, right? Seeing things means, oh, I see this, meaning this is not that. That's how I see it.
Mm-hmm.
Then we couldn't possibly have an experience of Nirvana in the same way we have discriminatory experiences. And yet, at the same time, Nirvana is something that we feel deeply in our heart. It's something that is, it's not external to us. It's not something we don't feel, but we don't feel it the way we feel other things. We don't feel, we don't have experiences of it.
Yeah.
Because it's unlimited.
I feel that sometimes we create our own prison and we put ourselves in there and we believe it. That is the true word. But if you can break your own jail, is your heart.
Yeah.
It is your determination. Yeah.
So we can't stop discriminating, but we don't have to take it so seriously.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your listening. Wonderful care.
Someone up front.
I wanted to follow up on this idea of self-reflection being the, you know, foundation to conflict resolution. And I just thought it tied in really beautifully with what you said about confirmation. That's so important in Zazen, because you can reflect on yourself and be quite quite discriminatory and, you know, find lots of fault. But this idea of confirmation, I think it's like so foundational to all creative practices, because you've always got that part of you that's saying, you know, you don't have anything to really to contribute. And also just made me think what you said about pure permission the other night. So.
Yeah. Yeah, the conflict. In the conflict work, counterintuitive insight is that typically mediators are taught you are a neutral and you're supposed to be open equally to all the parties in mediation. You're not supposed to have feelings about the conflict. And so you're supposed to set those aside if you have. And so in the work that we do, we say the opposite. We say, no, you need to pay attention to those feelings that you have. But instead of just taking the feeling at face value, you need to have the capacity to go deeper with that feeling. If you go deep enough with that feeling, you'll find connection. You'll find the key to what it is to connect to all the parties. So don't ignore what you feel. Use it to understand more deeply. And I think that's true also in creative work, right? We want to be able to, I think that what makes any art production valuable is the sense of connection that a person has when they view it or read it or hear it or whatever it is. There's a connection to our shared humanity. That's what makes art valuable. That's why at this point in time, I think it's just as important, possibly more important, to support the arts as it is to support the political side we're supporting. Because the arts keep humanity alive insofar as those who have political enemies think their enemies are working to destroy our humanity, our shared humanity, and we need to keep it alive through the arts. Because that's what happens when we something we're awakened, and it's in all of us. We might not be paying attention to it until we feel it through the art. And the person who's making the art has to one way or the other be able to get there in making them. Yeah. So it's the having the capacity to feel what we feel deep with that feeling, let it go all the way. And that's what we do in Zazen. We feel what we feel, and instead of building on it with our prejudices and our conditioning, we feel it and we let go. It's always feeling. One last one.
How do you let go?
There's no way to do it.
Oh, it happens.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know what it feels like to hang on, right? Hanging on. See it clearly. That's letting go. We hang on thinking it's going to work out. When you really pay attention to hanging on, you see it's that's letting go. There's no way to let go. If you make letting go into a task, right, it's just, you're just telling yourself to hang on even more. I guess it's 11:30, right? Everybody watch this? Yeah. So this can be great. And come back at 1 and have a good time. Sorry each other and yourself. And we'll come back at 1 and we'll do a little bit of the same thing we did morning. We'll have sitting, walking, sitting, break, talking, and we should have more time for this discussion. Idea. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.